The Transportation and Policy, Regional Governance Policy Committee is called to order, and I don't know if we have a quorum.
We
do, okay. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of the February 26th meeting, please? Ruslan Carlson, will you approve the minutes, please?
Yes, I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you. And any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes of the February 26, 2018 meeting are approved. Thank you. So, members, we do have two presentations today. One is from MnDOT, and I don't know that I've ever heard this presentation, so it seems like you guys are having success, and we want to hear about it. So, Towards Zero Death. And we're going to hear how that program is working. And then the second presentation is Metro Mobility Task Force. So, again, I think one we've all been interested for a while in hearing about. So if we can have you guys introduce yourselves for the record, and we can proceed.
Thank you. I'm Christine Hernandez. I'm the statewide Towards Zero Death Program Coordinator, and I am MnDOT.
And Madam Chair and members, my name is Mike Hansen. I currently serve as the Director for the Office of Traffic Safety in the Department of Public Safety. And we appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to you this afternoon about, I think, what is a bright spot and a positive movement in Minnesota.
Great. Whoever's going to proceed, please do.
Thank you. I was very excited to have this opportunity to talk about TZD because there has been such tremendous success in Minnesota. This is our vision that we created in 2003, and that's to reduce traffic-related fatalities and serious injuries on our roadways, and I'm talking about all roadways, not just the interstates and highways that MnDOT works through.
And again, it is a comprehensive, kind of a holistic approach to traffic safety issues. It brings to the table all of the entities and the organizations in state, county, and local government that can and do affect traffic safety issues. To illustrate some of the successes or why we think this is working so well, the graph that's shown on the screen now shows the trending fatality rate prior to the implementation or the beginning of the Towards Zero Deaths initiative or program. And then in the blue shaded area, you can see that in the last 15 years that we have realized a 45% decrease in the number of fatal crashes that are occurring on Minnesota roadways. And that is a tremendous success. Minnesota is looked at as a national leader in these areas, and it's in no small part thank you to all of the partners that we work with. And the good news is that trend is continuing through 2017, where we realized another 9% decrease in the number of fatal crashes that are occurring. We are the only state in the NHTSA Region 5 to see a decrease in the number of fatal crashes that are occurring. And to kind of compare us with some of our other neighboring states, in 2016, Iowa saw a significant spike in their numbers. In 2017, they reduced those by about 70 to 331. North Dakota remained at the same level from 16 to 17 at 113, and South Dakota realized a slight decline to 98 fatal crashes. Now, building on that, the cornerstone for the Towards Zero Deaths project, in the original concept, it was based on what we call the four E's of traffic safety, and these are the entities that have the most to do with traffic safety issues. Now, it's engineering, education, emergency medical services, and enforcement. All four of those things come together to affect how drivers behave and how the roads that they operate on are designed and built. In later years, we have added the 50 because we really realized that we cannot do this by ourselves. Even all four of those entities working together, we need the support of every Minnesotan and everybody who utilizes Minnesota roadways in order to ensure our success.
So that's one of our newer initiatives right now that MnDOT's kind of taking the lead on, is changing the culture in Minnesota around traffic safety, getting them to talk more about what the issues are and addressing them through their peers, their families, co-workers, and that sort of thing.
we often receive questions about what makes TZD successful. Well, as Christine alluded to earlier, it's an all-roads approach. It's not just state and interstate highways. It's local streets, county roads, township roads, all of that. Multidisciplined, so we involve all four of those E's. Again, the three state departments that are leading this effort, MnDOT, DPS, and the Minnesota Department of Health. And we all bring different skill sets to the table that have helped to ensure our success. This is a proactive, data-driven approach. We aren't just throwing things at the wall to see if they stick, but we actually have a very well-thought-out, very planned-out, deliberate approach to traffic safety issues. We've broken down all kinds of obstacles, time, attention, silos that state agencies and local governments can tend to build, resources, we share those, turf, all those things are going by the wayside as we work very closely to find better ways to make TZD work. A great example of that, shown in the picture that you see in the slide, is the cable median barriers. If you think 8, 9, 10 years ago, we were having a significant uptick in the number of CMEs or cross median events, where a vehicle on a freeway or a divided highway at high speeds would cross that median, enter oncoming traffic, and the results are almost always catastrophic in those events. Well, through study and through looking at this from the 4E approach, MnDOT identified the best way to prevent that was the cable median barriers. And because of the expansion of that cable median barrier project, we have almost eliminated CMEs in Minnesota.
And this picture's on I-94. We actually now have, I believe, a cable median barrier from border to border all across I-94. And I like this picture because it's not supposed to be able, or it's not in the design that it can stop a semi, but can you imagine what would have happened there if it didn't? And we've seen pictures like this many times.
And again, anybody who's traveled I-94 during rush hour knows how busy you can be, and that's when this crash happened. So you can only imagine what would happen if that 18-wheeler had gone completely through the median into oncoming traffic. We would have a very significant event. Our program structure, this slide might be a little complicated, but basically the TZD leadership team, as I mentioned, is the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Minnesota Department of Transportation, Minnesota Department of Health. We all come together to work closely on that. We have our TZD program teams, which are scattered across the state and made up of different entities that participate with us. And then through the Office of Traffic Safety, we have a number of program subcommittees. And then on the right, you can see some of the existing programs that we are administering. And this is not a complete list, but the Safe Roads Coalitions. I'll get to this again in a little bit, but the secret to our success is grassroots local involvement in all of our projects. The TZD Enforcement Program, we work very closely with Colonel Langer, with the State Patrol, as well as with over 300 other law enforcement agencies across the state. Through the Minnesota Department of Health, the Regional Trauma Center effort that has been very successful in, when a bad thing happens, getting people to a critical care facility quickly. Infrastructure improvements. MnDOT has done wonderful work in that area. We have a very robust child passenger safety protection program, motorcycle safety program that we are very proud of and that is continuing to expand. We work with the DWI courts and support those both in the metro and in greater Minnesota. And again, that's just kind of scratching the surface for the programs that we administer.
So I always say that TZD is a tangled web because we have so many partners, AAA, FHWA, all of our partners across the state. Whoops, I'm on the wrong slide then. Oh. This one.
Did I go?
That one.
There we are.
Sorry.
Sorry about that.
So what is nice about the partnerships and the multi-levels, whether it's from the state down, the grass tops support that we have and are very grateful for, but also the grassroots, so they kind of meet with our statewide partners. We have insurance companies. We have other companies that are helping us. But this shows the regions that TZD have set, or that we've set up across the state, and this took us 10 years to get TZD implemented across the state. I'm the statewide coordinator, and I oversee that program of work, and we have five regional coordinators that actually manage steering committees that are headed by the State Patrol Captain and the MnDOT District Engineers, bringing all our county and city partners together. And then on the other side is the law enforcement liaisons that are housed by DPS, but they're embedded in their own regions, similar to these, and they help support the law enforcement side of that and putting the initiatives that we know are effective.
The regional coordinators and the LELs are great partners, and they're kind of our eyes and our ears and our boots on the ground, so to speak, in Minnesota, and maintain those relationships with the local governmental units that are so important to our success.
So this is just one example. We struggled with that 4E emergency medical and trauma services because we were all working more preventive ways of effective countermeasures, but we didn't know how to pull them in until we established that statewide trauma system. And then we worked with dispatchers and the hospitals that could do auto launch and said it's okay for a dispatcher to dispatch the helicopter because the pilots need their practice anyway. They have to fly so many hours. But usually we had waited until law enforcement got there to make that decision if a crash needed to be transported either by ambulance or helicopter. So now we've expedited it and even set up that trauma system so they know which trauma center can handle what type of crash. So back in the day, 10, 15 years ago, they may go to the community local hospital, then they wait for someone to come in and assess them, then they're transported to HCMC or wherever regions, wherever a level one trauma hospital is. So now they know which one to go to, and they may bypass that community hospital to get the care expedited. So we get asked this question all the time. Can we get to zero? And we think it is attainable, but it does take all of our partners. It's not just MnDOT, it's not MDH, it's not DPS or State Patrol, but all of our local partners are on board with this. We work with the counties because we both, MnDOT and DPS, have to do a state highway safety plan. Well, now every county has a highway safety plan, so they can, or a county safety plan, so they can apply for HCIP funds and do the right fixes on our roadways that we know that are effective.
The other thing that I would like to point out about this slide is the important point to take away from it is zero really is attainable. A traffic crash is not an inevitable event as long as we have a human being and a car working together. They can all be prevented. It's just up to all of us, again, as Christine said, working together to identify the various solutions that will get to that point. So where are the deaths happening? The map that you see there now represents the number of traffic fatalities from 2013 to 2017. From orange representing the highest number of fatality counties all the way down to the dark blue, which represent the lowest number of fatalities that have occurred in that time period across the state. And I put that up there to kind of lead into the next two slides because this will also reinforce that concept that zero is attainable. In 2015, the counties that are shown in blue here, and there's 11 of them, had no traffic fatalities in them at all. So they attained zero fatalities. That trend continued into 2016, where we now have 15 counties that can count themselves as zero death counties. So again, this just demonstrates that by working together, we can get to those goals that we've all set for ourselves. We all know we have a number of ongoing challenges on our roadways, and there are four things that still kill more Minnesotans and more motorists than anything else out there: impairment, belts, distraction, and speed. To give you a little bit of an idea of how significant these four factors are, in 2015, 95 people were killed as a direct result of an impaired driver. 91 deaths were the result of somebody making the decision not to put a seatbelt on. 74 deaths were directly attributed to a distracted driver. And 78 deaths were attributed to somebody who was driving either over the speed limit or faster than the conditions would allow. 82% of all fatalities are represented in those four categories alone. So that's obviously where we're focusing a lot of our engineering and our behavior-based research to try and figure out how we can make further inroads in those categories.
So, as Mike said, those are our hot buttons, and that's the types of activities that we work with at the local level. You know, we assess where the counties are, what's your highest crash data, and encourage them to do effective countermeasures to mitigate those. But in the meantime, we also work on some of the, what we'd say, the lower level priorities, which now have risen higher because of our numbers coming down. So if you look at the motorcycle line, which is the top yellow line, we're running about 50 to 60 fatalities. And if you compare that to 358 preliminary that crashes or deaths that we had last year, that's a pretty big impact on where we need to start looking and working, which we have been, but it's now rising to the top. Pedestrian crashes, that's a tough one. DPS has extra enforcement grants for Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Yes.
That because the bulk of our fatalities in those two next two categories are in the metro. So we're working with Hennepin County, we're working with Ramsey County to help mitigate some of those deaths as well and investing more dollars there.
NHTSA just released a report this morning detailing the pedestrian and bicycle deaths in 2017. Minnesota is not alone in seeing an increase in those numbers, and it is something that is starting to gather a bit more attention even on the national scale.
So this is the same slide that we showed you earlier, only the bubbles on top is the legislation that has really helped the program move forward. For instance, in 2009, passing primary seatbelt law, our border states are envious of that. I presented in North Dakota, and they say that the law enforcement tell me they watch people buckle up when they drive into our state. It's like, wow, that's pretty impressive that we can actually change the behavior in North Dakota, and we're still working on our own. So that's the other kind of vision, is working with our border states to make those things happen. Ignition interlock program was another big success for the program. And then on the MnDOT side, we have found that in the work zones, when we actually made that, your fine is doubled in the work zone, and people didn't really understand that. So changing the language to, it's a whopping $300. So I think it changed the behavior there, as well as adding that extra incentive for if you're picked up for texting and driving, the secondary offense got increased. So those were all big milestones that we wanted to make sure, and thank you for all the assistance you've been giving us.
As Christine mentioned, you know, our neighboring states often come to us and ask us what's working, because we're kind of on the right side of these scales. North Dakota is currently pursuing a primary seatbelt law, and North Dakota is also, this year, they've initiated their own Towards Zero Deaths program that is just in the process of getting kicked off. That ends the formal part of our presentation, Madam Chair and members. We're more than willing to stick around, answer any questions that we can, anything else that you folks would like.
Thank you so much for your presentation, folks. And one thing I wanted to go back to was the motorcycles, pedestrians, and bicycles. Could you just tell, was there a number there, the total number, that is a part of 358? Or are those numbers outside of 358?
No, those are included within the 358. So you can see that, you know, we have 52 or 53 motorcycle deaths, 41 or 42 pedestrian deaths, and then it looks like 8 bicyclists that were killed in motor vehicle crashes.
Okay, thank you. So something like 100 then out of 358?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And also, is this supported with federal money? I've driven through Michigan lately and have noticed that they have posters up on their rest stop areas, talking about TZD. So just curious how other states are, you know, developing it.
Madam Chair, members, and this will I'll answer our part of it, and then Christine
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mr. Hanson.
OTS, or the Officer Traffic Safety, we are primarily funded through NHTSA with federal money. And so we manage upwards of 20-some programs that are directed at various traffic safety issues, something along the line of $15 or $20 million a year that are going to that. Last year, for the first time, the Minnesota Legislature also provided us with some additional funding for our crash records management system. And then there's a few other state-funded initiatives like the motorcycle safety program and so forth that we do receive funding for at OTS. But we are primarily a federally funded agency.
Okay, great. Thank you. Representative Bernardi, question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to get back to the same slide you were talking about motorcycles, and I think Anoka County, you represent part of Anoka County too, right?
Correct.
And I think they have a lot. I mean, this is an issue in Anoka County, our motorcycle fatalities and serious injuries. And then this pedestrian line that goes way up from 2014 to 2006. I'd like to know some analysis that you guys went through and some goals you set and measurements you're using to address why this happened, how what's being put in place so this can get lower. It looks like it's better this year, but the fact that it went up double and triple, like in 2 years, I'd really like to know about that. It's taken quite a I won't tell my commentary on it, but I think it's really, really important that we're addressing pedestrian fatalities because they're like the most vulnerable user on the roadway. And just so people know, in this data here, it's only related to car crashes, well, to crashes with a motor vehicle. They're not like tracking the light rail when it kills somebody. It's not being tracked in this data. So it's car centric. I think that's important for people to know. And I guess I will put my 2 cents. I knew that these problems were happening a lot because you mentioned Hennepin and Ramsey County, and I'd like to have you say what you're doing with those counties specifically, because it took a long time for TZD to get to the point where they recognized there were unique needs in the metropolitan area, because before that they couldn't get grant funding to work on pedestrian stuff. You know, I don't know if they can now, but it took a long time to get to the point to understand that the urban area had a very challenging and unique situation regarding pedestrians.
I think
Mr. Hanson?
Madam Chair, representatives, I think we both have probably a little bit of an answer mm-hmm. for that. Certainly the uptick in the pedestrian fatalities is of concern. As far as can I give you a concrete, hard, and fast reason for that occurring, I can't at this point. We're just starting to get our hands around some of the research related to that. What I can offer is that, you know, those four causes that I mentioned before when it comes to speed, distraction, impairment, and not necessarily seatbelts with pedestrians, but I think that those three things probably are going to weigh into that equation. And then as far as what we're doing within Hennepin and Ramsey County, the federal money that comes into the Office of Traffic Safety for pedestrian-specific programs is pretty limited. But we do our best to support the enforcement efforts in Minneapolis and St. Paul with, I would call, modest grants for pedestrian enforcement. And we work primarily with Minneapolis Police, St. Paul Police, and the University of Minnesota Police Department on those pedestrian enforcement efforts.
So you've heard of the walk for
Ms. Hernandez?
I'm sorry. I apologize. Representative Bernardi, the St. Paul having the walk or wait for me campaign that comes from the DPS grant-funded program. So we have been sharing the successes that have been happening there with their other counties in the state so that they can emulate the same kinds of activities. Duluth and Rochester, St. Cloud, all have some of those other types of similar situations. One of the things we looked at is unintended pedestrians, and that actually got some unexpected numbers that we are struggling to address. You know, if someone gets into a crash and they get out of their car, not a good idea. You're safer in your car with your seatbelt on. So some of those messages we're trying to get out to communities, particularly in our Minnesota weather. Minneapolis, we are working with them. They declared that they want to be a Vision Zero community. So we've been meeting with them and Hennepin County. And I believe they are in the process of hiring two Vision Zero coordinators to help with their projects. Some of the things that MnDOT are trying is getting people off the roadway, are more vulnerable users like pedestrians and bicyclists. So having the concrete barrier in lanes, we've got several sites across the state, mostly I believe in Minneapolis, that we're trying that. I know Alexandria did a pedestrian kind of speed calming project in their downtown with some other dollars. And then what we did decide was we need to revamp the Share the Road campaign. And what we found in our evaluation is people don't understand what that means. So we've been meeting with several different pedestrian and bicycle communities to design a new program that we can roll out statewide.
Follow-up, Representative Bernard.
Thank you very much. If I understood you correctly, you're doing research on this now to find out how come the numbers went up. I'd really like for you to share that with me, where you're at. And what I understand towards Vision Zero, it seems like it's more of a goal-setting program, more of an accountability program, just more rigor in the program. Have you found that to be true? And how are you incorporating the measurements and the performance measurements in the work of TVZ so that each community is getting the numbers? And I know there's issues with getting the numbers right now. I won't even bring up that subject. But I'd like to know more about that.
Mr. Nichols.
Thank you. So we're working on the numbers, as you said. As far as rigor, I don't know if they're at that level yet. When I talked to the public works director in Minneapolis, and they're just getting started. I will say we are there to help them. Towards Zero Death was actually patterned off of Sweden's Vision Zero program. So they are not mutually exclusive programs. I think what the bigger metropolitan cities are looking at is more emphasis on pedestrian and bicyclists than what the TZD program started with. So they're not mutually exclusive, and we will be at the table with them, as well as them being at the table with us. When we have our state conference, the Towards Zero Death conference, there's about 1,000 people that attend that. It's in Mankato this fall. And we have a track that is ped and bikes. We include them in our learning sessions. The other thing that we have been doing is 8 regional workshops that are spread out across the regions. Those happen in April and May. There's about anywhere from 100 to 200 people, traffic safety stakeholders that come. We'll have breakout sessions that do include discussions about pedestrian and bikes. I don't know, does that answer your question?
Mr. Hernandez, I see that we have Mr. Ranieri here. I don't know if you wanted to make a comment or two, Mr. Ranieri. You're on your feet.
My name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. And as Mr. Hernandez has stated, we just got started. In September, we passed the resolution. We worked very closely with MnDOT on the whole issue of safety. We have set up a task force. We are planning to start our planning process and have our strategies done by the end of this year. We are concerned about crashes in our city, and we've been working very closely with not only the county and the state.
All right, great. Thank
you
very much.
So we're not coordinating, we're not duplicating, and have good working relationships with state agencies.
Excellent.
And then just one more follow-up? Yeah, just follow-up or maybe a comment. I represent suburban Ramsey County, and you had mentioned that you're working with Ramsey County and Hennepin County, but when you were talking about who you were working with, you were working with St. Paul. which it's important to note, great city, and it's half of Ramsey County. So it's important to think of Ramsey County suburban in this equation, because there's a lot of pedestrians in Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and if you get hit further out in the suburbs, you have a better chance of dying. Maybe not as many people are getting in crashes, but they're going faster. So I just want to make sure that all of Ramsey County and the communities that I represent are being included as well.
Okay. We'll move on. Representative Bernstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, I wanted to make sure that Mr. Ranieri had a chance to look at Vision Zero. He's got a great document, and maybe we could circulate that at a later date. But my question, thank you for your work. My question is, as you know, Representative Uglem and I have a bill on hands-free addressing some of the distracted driving. We had an incredible hearing. Thank you, actually, Madam Chair, for having that hearing last year. And I was hoping that you could update us. I know that last year's statistics showed a real uptick in distracted driving deaths and injuries in proportion to others. Is that trend line continuing in your latest data?
Mr. Hansen?
Madam Chair and members, the data that I have available at this point, sir, is a little bit premature, so I wouldn't want to necessarily say that with 100% certainty. I think and Colonel Langer could probably testify to this too. Determining distraction as a causal factor or as the primary causal factor in any crash can be difficult. And so it's something that, as we look at it from a research standpoint, we have to be somewhat careful of if we're going to put real hard and fast numbers out there on it. But I think, you know, we cannot discount the fact that, that distraction is part of our lives and part of what goes on in many motor vehicles today. And, you know, through our projects and through the TZD approach, we're trying to change that behavior, change that culture, and create a more safer culture on Minnesota roads.
Any follow-up, Representative?
Yeah, just thanks. So when will you have more updated numbers on different causal, you know, I think the way we have speed, distraction, and several others, but when will you have more up-to-date numbers on that?
Mr. Hansen.
Madam Chair and representatives, I would anticipate we should have something available by early to midsummer or something along those lines, but I hate to put our researchers into a box. There's only, you know, so many things that we can do with the resources that we have. If there's something specific, sir, that I can research for you, I would be very happy to have one of our researchers take a look at that for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. And to that point, Mr. Hansen, the column by Mr. Harlow, Tim Harlow, in the Star Tribune maybe a month and a half ago regarding this very same, you know, 2017 report, I am so certain, and I'll go find it, but I thought that he said that distracted deaths were like 16. So might he have gotten his information wrong, or, you know, is there quite a difference in how it's being, I guess, reported?
Madam Chair and representatives, I guess without looking specifically at what was in that article and comparing that with our data, it would be hard for me to give you an accurate answer.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Koznick.
Thank you. I think I just broke the microphone again from last week. Thanks for being here and with your report. Looking at the five E's, the third one is education and outreach. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit more about that, of what you do for educating the driving public, and if you have any ideas or thoughts on retesting, relicensing.
Ms. Fernandez?
Thank you. So part of the education process is, well, what we have found for an effective countermeasure is doing enforcement with education. So we tell people we're going to be out there enforcing DWI. And then they go do it. So That's an effective countermeasure, that NHTSA support. So we stress that. We work with our regions to do big news conferences or media campaigns, social media. Our number one target market is young adult males. So this year we started doing those more clever messages on the overhead boards, what we call Message Monday. The males in the 20-somethings or 30s typically aren't watching TV, reading the newspaper. They're on social media, but we can hit them right where they are driving. And obviously we have safety precautions so that if a crash occurs, you know, or we need the sign for something else for weather or safety-related reasons, we take that message down, or if it's dry time, we don't run it. But those messages, what we want is to have water cooler talk, so people go, oh, did you see the sign Monday morning? And that's, again, moving towards that long-term culture change. Does that help?
I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about, like, driving skills and re-educating and people losing their skills. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe our more senior drivers sometimes want to brush up on skills, or even somebody like myself that hasn't taken the test in, I don't even know how long it has been, 30 years.
Mr. Hanson, you want that one?
Madam Chair and members, and thank you for that question, Representative. Education really is the key to a lot of the parts of towards zero deaths. I'm going to come to your question, but I'd like to highlight one thing that was a great accomplishment several years ago, and it was thanks to action on the part of the legislature, and that's the parent component to driver's education as part of the graduated driver's license law that is now into effect. And it's made a significant difference, and allows us to reach out to those younger age drivers, which are really going to be the key to changing this culture behind the wheel. And so through the Office of Traffic Safety, we developed that curriculum, and then with the help of the legislature to implement that and to require that as part of driver's ed, that is making a difference with our young drivers. If you look at the trend line for the number of teenagers who are killed in motor vehicle crashes, that continues to go down. The policy issue regarding testing of older drivers, I would have to defer to either our council or to driver's vehicle services or to the DPS commissioner's level. There may be some value in that, but I would hesitate to get into a policy discussion, sir.
Madam Chair, follow up on along those lines. Do you have data at all? Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have data at all about crashes or deaths caused by unlicensed drivers?
Madam Chair and Representatives, we do have that data. I don't have it with me. I could provide that to you, sir, if you would like.
I would.
Okay.
Great. Representative Hirsthaus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we've been having this discussion, I just recalled my father telling me when I got that first plastic card in the mail that said I was now licensed to drive, that you won't really know how to drive until you've logged a million miles. And I suspect that probably still holds true today, but even for some that have that amount, maybe not any better. My question is about the graph that you have up. And I noticed there was a sharp or marked increase in 2014 in motorcyclists and pedestrians. And I was wondering if you had any correlation or causal factor for that. Was it that the weather was nicer for those two summers and people were out longer? I also, as a Metro legislator, seem to recall since about 2013 that it seemed to be an inordinate number of pedestrian deaths caused by LRT collisions with pedestrians. Do you have any data as to how many people are dying from the train? And I'll let it go at that.
Mr. Hanson.
Madam Chair and members, I don't have anything specific, sir, that I can give you. If I recall correctly, I think weather is probably one of the primary drivers for that 2014 to 2015 spike. I believe the motorcycle riding season started pretty early that year, and that probably resulted in, you know, with that extended driving season, there's extended risk, extended exposure. So I think that that's probably what drove those numbers up. If you want something further on that, again, I could certainly have our researchers take a look at that. And I think that's probably the same thing with the pedestrian, the number of pedestrians that year as well.
Representative Hertas.
Yes, but do you have any data of those pedestrian deaths, how many were caused by LRT?
Mr. Hanson.
Madam Chairman, representatives, LRT deaths are not included in these stats. The train is not considered a motor vehicle. In order for the crash to count in our database, to have a crash report written by a police officer, has to involve a motor vehicle. The LRT or any train-involved fatality would be handled by a different division.
So you don't collect that data?
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you don't collect that data at all?
Representative, no, we do not.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I just want to make a comment that some of those messages on the freeway are very, very clever. And one comment as a plug for the hands-free bill. Yesterday, as I was coming in on 35E, I'm following a van, the last couple of exits, that's going very slow. And then the person got off on Kellogg, same place that I did. And as I'm passing the car, she's turning into Sears, I can see she definitely has her cell phone up to her ear. So again, we have a long ways to go on education. But my question is, do you have data for serious injuries and as it relates to people using the different modes of transportation?
Mr. Hanson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do track serious injuries, at least in the Office of Traffic Safety, related to motor vehicle crashes. And so any type of collision involving a motor vehicle, whether it's car-to-car, car-to-truck, car-pedestrian, or car-bicycle, we would have those statistics. For injuries outside of that arena, I think maybe Director Kindy or the Department of Health might be in a better position to address that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I think that's interesting in regards to the last question, actually, about other serious injury, because I was going to ask, a couple of questions, actually. One, have you identified maybe some of the confounding factors, or have you been able to isolate some of the success of the program to some of your initiatives? I mean, some of them obviously are not going to be quantifiable, but things like the barriers and things like that. And as part of that, those compounding factors may be improvements in vehicle safety. For example, I mean, if there are still significant injuries due to crashes, but deaths have decreased, is some of that due to improvements in vehicle safety? And have you been able to isolate those figures at all?
That's engineering. I'll leave that to you.
All right, Ms. Hernandez.
Thank you. We purposely don't isolate, and the reason why we kind of anecdotally talk about it, but we want all of our traffic safety partners to feel like they have a vested interest in the things that we're doing. So from an engineering perspective, yes, we can say that cable median barrier has reduced head-on crashes.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as counting people or deaths, we don't do that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it seems like that would be valuable information to know. I'm sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like that would be valuable information to be able to isolate those things, to know which initiatives are effective and which may not be. As another question, it looks like, going back to this chart, from 2003 to 2010 or 11, it looks like there was a significant reduction in deaths, and that trend line clearly decreased significantly. But it appears to the trend line has sort of evened out since then. So are you looking at making significant changes to your methods now to maybe initiate a new downward trend line, or what are you looking at for that? Or have you done what you can do and now it's maintaining?
We like that one.
I'll take it.
Mr. Hansen.
Madam Chair, representatives, you've hit on a good point. The Office of Traffic Safety, as I mentioned earlier, we work very closely with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, where we receive the vast majority of our funding. The programs that we administer all have to be data-driven, and they have to meet what NHTSA calls the countermeasures that work strategy. And the countermeasures that work is a book that's about that thick. Mm-hmm. And it has all kinds of different approaches to traffic safety issues related to all kinds of different circumstances and roadway types and things like that. Basically, everything that we do, all of the programs that we administer, have to come out of that. With that being said, I will tell you that I am always looking for the next best thing. And we do have some flexibility with NHTSA to try some of these new and innovative different approaches, but we're kind of limited with that, basically due to resources. So we try and make sure that our researchers are keeping an eye on trend lines, and if something starts to crop up that we need to pay attention to, then, you know, we'll see if there's a program that we can implement to address that particular factor.
Representative New, any follow-up?
Yes. So is there anything specifically that you're doing now, or are you just sort of maintaining and monitoring right now?
Mr. Hansen?
Madam Chairman and members, we know the four things that kill and severely hurt people more than anything else. That's speed, distraction, impairment, and lack of wearing belts. And, you know, our belt rate has dropped a little bit, and so we're looking at ways to try and reinforce that. We are always looking for different ways, more effective ways to handle the impairment problem, which is being compounded by all the other substances that we're now seeing. And again, Colonel Langer could address that much better than I can right now. So we're looking for different strategies there. Distraction. We're all well aware of what goes on in the cars around us as we travel the freeways every day. So we have to try and find better strategies and better ways to educate people that that's not acceptable behavior, and to change that behavior and change that culture, as Christine mentioned earlier. So do I have anything specific that I can give you? I wish I did, but I don't at this time. But we are looking for the next best answer.
Okay, great. We're going to have one more question from Representative Barr, and then maybe a quick comment from Representative Bernardi. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious on the ongoing challenges, impairment, belts, distraction, speed. Have you ever done a look at what the ages across each of those are? And could you share that with us? Or,
yep. Representative Mr. Hansen again?
Madam Chair, members, we do have that data. I don't have it with me, and I would be happy to have that put together for the committee.
Yeah, I think that would be great. Yes, to see some of your cross tabs on ages and so on would be really good. And Representative Bernardi.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to ask for the data that you showed us about fatalities. Could you show us the data regarding serious injuries, the trend lines, and as it relates to all the different modes? That would be very helpful.
Right, we'll make a note of that, and I think that would be helpful for all of us. So, right, wrapping up, thank you so much. Really interesting information, and I'll just add one little bit because this kind of piqued my interest, traveling through both Michigan and Tennessee, which are states probably with similar amounts of miles of roadway. Both of them have a number of 900 roadway deaths, which is like, oh my gosh, right? So, you know, congratulations to us, and it's exciting. So, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for your time today.
Yep. All right. Moving on here to Transit Services Director Nick Thompson, and we're getting set up, I see. We'll take 2 minutes while you're doing that, Nick. And
I'll go
talk to Mr. Barr.
Yeah.
2 minute recess.
Oh,
yeah. Hmm? Oh, you do? Oh, gosh. Okay.
That's how you end up with
I think good. All right. I want to welcome Mr. Thompson from Met Council, and all right. So, and we're going to let you go through your testimony. There may be questions, but let's hold our questions to the end, and I think we have a few people who want to also have a few minutes of testimony, so we'll let you go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Nick Thompson. I'm the Director of Metropolitan Transportation Services at the Met Council. Within my division at the Met Council is the Metro Mobility Program. I'm here today to give you an overview of the results of the Metro Mobility Task Force, a report that was required by the legislature and submitted 2 weeks ago, and I'll walk through what the information of the task force and what their recommendations were. So this is a task force that was established in special session law chapter 3 last year with three goals: identify options and methods to increase program effectiveness and efficiency, minimize program costs, and improve service, including through partnerships with taxis and taxi service providers and transportation network companies, otherwise known as TNCs, and in Minnesota those are Uber and Lyft, who are part of the task force. I believe this task force came out of presentations we made last year regarding the growing costs of metro mobility and some of the service challenges we are facing. The organizational structure, as prescribed by law, was 18 members. Met Council staff provided support to this. They began their task force last August and completed their work this February. Within that, they met monthly, and then they divided into different work groups, one on industry work group, one on customer needs, and one on costs. This chart before you shows the members of that task force. There's each of the seven counties in the metro area had representatives. We left it up to the counties to appoint their members. Six of them appointed county commissioners, and in Dakota County, they appointed a city council member from West St. Paul who happened to have a daughter who was a customer of Metro Mobility. We had members from Transportation Accessibility Advisory Council at the Met Council, and industry was represented by Uber, Lyft, taxi companies, and then there was state agencies represented also. The report, as prescribed, that the task force created and submitted on February 14th, had to describe the Metro Mobility Program, and I'll go through some of those findings of how the program is designed. That was a lot of the work of the council, of the task force, was kind of understanding the program first so they can make good recommendations on how to make improvements. Summarize the work of the task force, identify options, specifically at least three options for new service models within the Metro Mobility, and then provide recommendations both for the program changes and any legislative changes. I'll step back a little bit and describe the Metro Mobility Program itself, in case you're not aware of some of the details. This is a service that's guaranteed as a civil right and regulated by FTA, or the Federal Transportation Administration. It is a public transit service. That means it's a shared ride service. For people who are unable to use regular transit service, at least sometimes because of something, a symptom or effect of their disability. It is not a service for those available to all those who aren't able to drive. It's those that are unable to use public transit. They are all riders that are first certified by our service, and it's shared ride and door through door. And door through door is important. The driver gets off the vehicle and goes to the door of where the customer is and then escorts them to their destination at the end of the trip. And that's one of the features that kind of the task force looked at would really affect the services that they could prescribe. In our state, we have two service areas for Metro Mobility. We have the what we call the ADA service area, and this is the federally prescribed area. This is in the area that we have fixed transit. So everywhere within 3/4 of a mile of our existing fixed route transit, within the exact same hours, that is the ADA service area as we prescribe it. That is, has its regulations prescribed by federal law that guide how that service operates. One of the key regulations there is you cannot deny a ride. There's no service denials for anything within that, what would be the lighter blue area of this map. The second area is the area that was created in 2006 and prescribed in state law. This is really what the transit taxing district was in 2006. This is what we call non-ADA, but to a customer, it's a service that looks very similar between the federal and the state area. The vehicles are the same, the drivers are the same, same performance targets. But we have more flexibility in that area because its state law is less prescriptive than federal law. So we do have trips that we do not provide when requested in that area because we may not have capacity at the time. So that's a key difference. And that really gathers a lot of the findings of the task force, those two different areas. If you look at the two different areas, a couple key differences between those two. The goal of the federal area is to make it comparable to fixed route. So same hours, general same travel time compared to fixed route. The goal at the state area was to provide greater access to those that were receiving Metro Mobility service outside of the federally required. There's a certification process that's federal that is not in state law, but we apply to both the same. The service area, as I mentioned, our transit taxing district today is larger than was there in 2006, but by law we restrict the boundaries of the service area to the 2006 taxing area. The hours of service are comparable to fixed route in the ADA area. In the state area, it is comparable, but each city basically within that area has its own hours of operations for Metro Mobility. Some of areas have transit all 24 hours a day, so they have Metro Mobility 24 hours a day. Other cities maybe have 5:30 a.m. to 8:30 at night. It varies by city, and that's something we provide. We make sure the customers are aware of. We, as I mentioned, we do not deny trips in the federal area, but can in the state area. Up until 2 years ago, we really were not denying trips anywhere on the system. But as demand continued to grow and our capacity was constrained, we did start to deny some trips in that state area. And we try to provide an alternative to that customer if we have to deny their trip. This is a service that you book in advance. It's not like regular transit where you can walk out and get a ride today on an unplanned trip. You need to plan ahead. And so it's 1 to 4 days in advance where you can book your trip. If you have the same trip every day, where to work, for example, at the same time, we do have standing orders where we can prescribe and so that it picks you up every day at 8 o'clock, as an example. For some customers, that works. The fare is higher. The fare can be up to 2 times what your regular fixed route fare is. We implemented a new fare increase in October 1st, and for a Metro Mobility customer, the fare is $3.50 on an off-peak and $4.50 for a ride in the peak period. We also implemented a distance surcharge on October 1st in the state area. So if trips are longer than 15 miles in that non-ADA area, we add 75 cents to the fare. And then the purpose of the trip is it's whatever the customer wants that trip to be. There are no restrictions on the trip purpose, and there cannot be in the ADA. So as the task force was gathering, they were trying to understand what their requirements are and what new service models would be. They looked at both federal and state requirements. Basically, they tried to, and we'll talk about what the service models are, but really they settled on options that were options that the customer would choose. They would opt into the new proposed services. This allowed them to provide more flexibility. But there's quite a difference in what the services they provided and what the federal requirements are for Metro Mobility. A lot of those are around the drivers, driver screening, driver training, the vehicle type and vehicle requirements, and whether or not it's a shared ride or not. So this table here documents the key areas the task force looked at in trying to design their service and understand what they would be recommending and how it would compare to the existing service. Just met more by the numbers. Last year, looks like our budget's going to come in, or the cost of the service last year, about $64.8 million. That resulted in 2.26 million rides. We typically average about 7,500 rides per day. This year, in 2018, we're averaging about 9.5% above that. So ridership is up since January 1st, actually since October 1st. But that's a kind of a typical day that you see there. We have 40,000 customers that are certified to ride the service, though probably about half of those are regular users in a given year. Our vehicles are mostly vans. We do have the task force spent a lot of time trying to understand if there's a different fleet mix or different ways to procure the capital for the fleet to reduce costs. But in the end, they really settled that the right using the fully accessible vans that or buses that we have, with a few exceptions, are the best way to deliver the service. Right now, it's 93 communities. Trips are about 10 miles long, and this is an important factor. The length of the trip really guides the cost of the trip and the service options that they had. All of this is contracted service. We competitively bid the service by zones, and they're provided by major transit providers that provide this service similar. Some of those providers provide this paratransit service in other communities too. But we generally have 5 or 6 year competitive contracts that we get multiple bids on, so the prices of these are very competitive. The fleet itself is owned by the Met Council, but the service, the drivers are provided by the contractor, the oversight, the management, the booking of trips are provided by the contractors. We divide it into zones. The zones are divided in a way to make the contracts big enough to be competitive, but also where the trip patterns generally are. We made some major changes in 2015. We used to force customers to transfer at zone boundaries, and that was not good. You know, we'd make the customer who was traveling across that boundary switch to another bus. It was inefficient for us and also an inconvenience for the customers. And so now the service allows wherever you start, you get to finish your trip on the same bus. We also provide a service for adult-based training centers. That's a separate contract that's currently out for bid now. This is a little bit unique, but it was an efficient way to schedule. These are all the same trips scheduled on a daily basis. And that's about 400,000 of those 2.26 million rides. A lot of what the task force recommended was built around a service that we've had running for 15 years in this region. It's called Premium On Demand. This is same-day service. So, as I mentioned before, the customers do need to book their trip in advance 1 to 4 days. Premium same-day is for those that need a trip today, and they didn't have it scheduled. And they can opt to use a taxi service. So they request a premium same-day. We let the taxi company know that they're eligible, and then the taxi company agrees to provide that trip. We structure the fares differently on that. The customer pays the first $5 of that fare. We pay the next $15 if it gets up to a $20 fare. And then any cost on that taxi ride greater than $20 would be the customer's responsibility. Generally, this results in a lower, less than $20 fares. Customers are very adept at making sure they use this service when they have the shorter trips, and provides a good option that really is the model that the task force recommended to expand to include the TNCs into this type of model. Here's a little bit more information about the fleet we have. The buses that you see on the top picture are very visible. 518 buses in their system. We're adding roughly 60 to 70 more buses every year to this fleet because we meet demand. As demand increases, we have to provide buses to meet that demand. So if you look at all the fleet owned by the Met Council, it's the Metro Mobility buses that is really the growing area of the bus fleet in this region. We purchase the buses. We provide them to the contractor to operate. The contractors maintain the buses, and then we provide oversight. Roughly $83,000 per bus when you include the technology. And these buses last about 5 years. They put a lot of miles on in a short time. So they're out on the road often 16 hours straight per day, sometimes 7 days a week. This is the chart that really kind of spurred, I believe, a lot of discussion last year at this committee and as part of the task force, is that these costs are increasing. 6 to 9% was the average increase of these costs. And if you commute, we see no future demand change to that future growth. We know it's a function of our population. Our population in the region is growing. It's also a function of a profile of our customers. As the older population definitely are users of this, and we see that demographic growing. So we expect continued growth in this program, and the costs continue to grow also. Last year, we do always a little bit of an exception. We ended the year with only 1% growth, which is the lowest growth we had in several years. There's a few reasons we believe that occurred. Number one is we were having a driver shortage, and so I believe some of the customers were not being able to get served, and we're switching some of their service or taking fewer rides. But we did implement a driver wage increase in October, and now I think demand has returned. We've been able to attract more drivers and retain existing drivers better, too. But it's definitely some definitely a concern. This is basically all state general funds going into that budget that you see in that growth. It is a costly service on a per-trip cost. It's roughly $23.84. This is the 2015 numbers. So it's a very costly service. We definitely acknowledge that. But when we look at our peer regions, peers were selected for regions that had similar types of service. In many cases, were similar size cities, though there are a few larger cities here that we are considering peers, because if you look at their service model, they're very similar. We're on the very low end of the cost per trip compared to our peers. And this really kind of influenced what the task force, too, about what's the potential for the new service models. Are we going to save money or not if we could implement more TNCs or taxis? So it was something they were wondering about. But I highlight in yellow there the Boston model. Boston was one of the regions that has used Uber and Lyft in their paratransit model, and to some definitely good success, and we used a lot of their findings and presented that to the task force. But they were also starting at a much higher cost per trip. And so I think expanding their service to TNCs and taxis really made a lot of sense in Boston. And we do expect it will work well here, too, but the savings may be not as great as Boston could have achieved. So this is the chart of what the service models that were recommended. And I'll kind of walk through this. They came up with four service recommendations. The task force recommended that the core service, or the base service, that needs to continue. There's absolutely no way that they saw that could be changed or eliminated. They said the services that they're recommended are additional services, and so they divided it into two different types of services. One is a set of shared service model, and one is what a task force called premium, which is an unshared ride or a single trip or single passenger. Within those two, shared and unshared, they said there are two types of services within that. One is where the special transportation service providers that are certified by the state would be the providers of the service, and another one would be taxis, Uber, Lyft, TNCs. And the difference in there is that the special transportation services generally have more accessible vehicles in their fleet. They have a higher training and background check requirements of their drivers, and they have a couple different options there. The TNCs, at least as part of the task force, said they were not willing to meet the STS service requirements for back driver training and background checks. And they also, there were some severe limitations in how much of their fleets were fully accessible. So the task force felt that we needed a variety of options, that if you could implement all these options, the suite of services is what the task force recommended, these six different services. The shared options, at least for the TNCs, are not currently available in the metro area market. In many other cities, they do have a shared option available. In Uber Pool, Lyft Line, or some names of brands that they use in other cities, There was no commitment by those companies to bring that service to the Twin Cities. So the task force said when these services are available in our market, they would be good additions to the Metro Mobility service model. And so that's how it was left. There was also some definitely concern about the fleet, and you'll see in some recommendations about, we had a couple industry providers, not TNCs, that said they would not add accessible vehicles to their fleet. They could not financially afford to do that. And so different options came out of that. A lot of discussion was held by the task force about the requirements for driver training, background checks, and they settled on these different suites. And it really, if you see this now, it becomes a fairly complex suite of options if we were fully implement these. And some of the recommendations that I'll get to talk about how that we can manage that complexity. Because it is a client-based customer's Metro Mobility, many of them are vulnerable adults. Some of them would have challenges navigating a variety of choices, and so how you would implement this would be key. The task force saw several advantages for this, but then, number one, they said these had to be opt-in services. They had to be the customer opting in. And that allows us, by the customer opting in, to be more flexible. If we're requiring it, then all the requirements, FTA requirements and state requirements, flow down to the service model. But if the customer opts into one of these new services, they can be more flexible. By adding a suite of services, maybe it's a way that we manage some of that growth so that we continue to have a very large base Metro Mobility system, but some of that growth we could peel off under some of these TNC and taxi models that would maybe be lower cost delivery. The task force definitely saw that as a good option. Definitely have customers that could not use taxi, Uber, or Lyft today, so they should only be put on a service like a special transportation service. Because of their disability, it would not be appropriate for them to be on one of these other services. So we really got to be sure that they are choosing the right service for the right customer. Premium service definitely is a better service. It meets, you know, if it's a shorter trip, it's a direct trip for a customer, there's a tremendous amount of benefits to come out customer for a premium trip. So should it be priced the same or not? One of the key differences is that when we offer a shared ride, Federal Transit Administration reimburses the state roughly $4.70 for each trip. For a premium trip, they say that is not public transit, so we will not reimburse the $4.70 for that trip. So we felt, the task force talked a lot about that. That's really a cost, part of the cost model is if they're not going to be reimbursed for the trip, we have to acknowledge that is part of your cost of the service. And so, but they definitely saw in Boston, they saw a lower price per trip than their regular base service. And a lot of places have that. So there's a place that this fits into the market. The task force also talked a lot about the risks. We think we have a fairly straightforward service today that we try to make it as one service. And we have many customers that struggle with some of our service requirements. And so they saw it as a risk that this vulnerable population could be some issues with implementing this. A couple of the issues that they saw is that on our Metro Mobility service today, we have cameras, we have voice recordings of every transaction, we can go back and investigate every phone call. Some of those things would not be available to the Met Council for oversight. So how would we investigate complaints? That's a risk. This is something we do on a daily basis, and it's valid that we need to monitor and provide oversight, and we'd be shedding some of that ability to do oversight. Now, the companies themselves have their own oversight mechanisms, so the level of risk is not quite understood yet on that. Because if you're an Uber user, you get to rate the driver and things like that. That provides some of that risk management just in a different way. So that was something task force wanted to make sure they pointed out. The other big change would be that today customers are required, the drivers are required to pick up the customer in a door-through-door and escort that customer both directions, unless the passenger says they do not want that escort. Very few of our passengers do not want that escort. Many of our passengers could not use the service without the assistance of the driver. And so, again, some of these models, the driver would just pick them up at the curb. So there's a part of the customer base that would not be able to use some of these optional services. Safety and security is one I've talked about. The accessible fleet is definitely a concern that we have. What is the capacity of the fleets that are out there? And then what devices would you have for monitoring? So in addition to that table of service models, there's another option that is either a service or a way to reduce some of the state funding for this. There was a lot of work on the task force kind of talking about a potential partnership with DHS. There are customers of Metro Mobility that are certified through DHS as waived service clients that use Metro Mobility. And in those cases, half of their fare is paid through by federal grants. We think that there possibly is an option where we could have half of the cost of the trip paid by federal reimbursement through a DHS program if we can integrate the two DHS customer base and our customer base. And it might require legislative changes too, but for example, right now 96% of the cost is borne by the state. If you took a $26 trip and were able to have half of that reimbursed by the federal government through the DHS program, you could provide the same number of trips but reduce the state share of the program. So we think there's potential there. We just are uncertain of how much potential there is because we are not allowed to share data between the Metro Mobility customer base and DHS's database of customers who are on waived services. So one of the recommendations I'll talk about is allowing passing legislation that would allow some data integration between those two and coordinating. And after, if we had that, then we'd be able to potentially design a program that would be able to recapture or capture some of those federal funds for the existing program that we are not able to capture today. So there's specific recommendations. The task force recommended several steps for the council to pursue and several for the legislature, and I'll walk through those. Number one is the pilot project that of the service models that I talked about in that table. They basically said your base service, there's no changes recommended for that, but start to enter into discussions with the TNCs, taxis, and SDS providers to figure out how you can implement and pilot this and broker these trips. We feel that we can do that without any legislative changes, and we've already prepared to begin that discussion. And so that's something the council is undertaking this year. They definitely strongly recommend that you pilot it in some limited fashion, not roll it out across the system, because there's a lot they felt in the time frame they didn't know. How are we going to will the customers understand this? Will it change their usage patterns? In places that have implemented TNCs, customers have adapted well to it, but they've started to take more trips than they were before. So each trip was cheaper, but the customer is using it more often, so they had to do things like cap the number of trips and other things to manage the control of costs. So we feel that a pilot is the best way to implement that, and we're moving forward with that. For the legislature, they've talked a lot about providing funding to study and invest technology innovations such as a single point reservation system, and this is to get towards that complexity. If all of a sudden we have a suite of six different options, we don't want the customer choosing the wrong option for their disability, and so maybe there's a system, a reservation system, where they request it, and somebody, a contractor or the council, says this is the best trip. We put you on the best trip for your needs, for your trip, and maybe for the best cost-effective trip for us too. So how that reservation system would work, the task force did not get into that, if it's where it should be located, what it would cost, but they just felt that because of all these new services, there might be most efficient to have a central reservation type system. And in first blush, it would be some technology system, and they just assumed that there would be some cost with that, but they did not explore that in their time frame. Because of the industry saying they didn't have financial, they could not add accessible vehicles to their fleets cost effectively, there was a recommendation that some sort of incentive program be provided so that there are more accessible vehicles, or it makes economic sense for the businesses, TNCs, to add accessible vehicles to their fleet. There's no need for them all to be accessible, but there is a fear that if a lot of the customers shift over these models, there would not be enough accessible vehicles in that industry fleet today, there isn't today, to provide, to meet the demands. And so there was a general recommendation that some sort of incentive be provided to add to the accessible fleet. Other recommendations for the council is continue this exploring with DHS, how we could design and implement this program, as I mentioned, to capture some of these federal funds, specifically, especially if we were granted the ability to share data between us, then we'd be able to develop exactly what this program would stand or would develop into to capture those funds. Increase the flexibility of the non-ADA trips. This is, so in that, if you refer back to that map, that area that is not federally mandated is where we have the most flexibility. The state requirements on that are very small, which means we can try different pilots in those. Even in the long term, or maybe that area is only provided by one extreme would be TNCs and taxis are the provider in that area. That's one extreme that you could do in there that you cannot do in the federal area. So they said that's an area that maybe you have the most flexibility to try things, and which in the end would actually improve, possibly improve service for customers. It'd be different, but it might. It's a good potential there. For legislature, they recommended facilitating this between DHS and Metro Mobility. We work with DHS, but we, as the council, don't understand their programs. They, their especially, don't necessarily understand our services and how we can make those work and what are the legal and legislative requirements. So, where you can facilitate that, and really, this is where the counties saw potential too. A lot of these clients that we see as potential market for capturing federal funds come into the service through the county service provider. And so the county commissioners on the task force really saw this as a really good potential to relieve some of their administrative issues, provide better service to their customers, and reduce the state costs of the service. The last, some of the last recommendations were, you know, in, we know that if we were to roll out these services, we would really have a high hurdle to explain it to this customer base. Even the premium same-day taxi service that we've had for 15 years is not even, the awareness level on that is low. The understanding by some of our customers, many of the trips are not even are booked by a care provider of the customer. So we have a lot of outreach we would have to do to implement these and make sure that they are safely implemented. Customers are safe. Providers are confident in how they work. And so we would expect to have pretty big, robust marketing campaign. But we do have many good mechanisms for that. We know all of our customers. We have a way to reach all our customers or their care providers. And so we feel that that would be important to make this successful. We need to continue to market and analyze our program, which I would expect you would expect us to do. And then lastly, this task force started off saying this is an essential service. Task force members uniformly said that they didn't feel it was their responsibility to cut the service. They wanted to provide better service to the customers in the area, maybe different choices, but so they wanted to reiterate to the legislature that this is a service that's essential to many people and it needs to be ensured because it's a state, basically a state-funded service. Establish some sort of source that guarantees that, that future demand and growth can be met. So that is the task force findings. There's a report that's out with a large appendix of all the presentations and information. I did want to touch on a couple of things that are also happening with Metro Mobility. That because we were before this committee last year talking about the challenges, talk a little bit about things that are occurring in addition to the task force work and recommendations. We did raise the driver wage on October 1st, and that has really changed the market for our drivers. We are retaining drivers now and dramatically increasing our number of applicants. And so we were the lowest paying kind of driver wage in the market. We are competing against other bus providers. We're competing against any delivery driver. And so we were way below market and could not attract and retain drivers. And a lot of our issues and concerns and complaints from the customers came because of the drivers. And so we think this wage increase is really changing that factor. And it's early, but we're seeing some positive results of that. We When we raised the fare on October 1st, there was a big change for some customers. And some of we reduced some of the incentives for group rides at that time. We found that there are some markets, especially senior centers, where they feel they can organize trips and have group trips made on Metro Mobility. And so we've introduced a group ride that if they have at least five customers going from the same center to the same location, we'll give them a reduced fare, dramatically reduced fare. It's more efficient for us and fairly easy to implement, and is a good way to provide that service. And really that target market seems to be the senior living centers around the metro. But it's just starting, so it hasn't taken off too much. This taxi service that we've had for 15 years, customers that were going to the task force said, why do I have to book it the same day? Can I book it in advance? And so we've now implemented that. And we expect the taxi service will increase in use. And that taxi service is costing the state less per trip than a Metro Mobility ride. So we see that as a positive. This spring, we will implement a fixed route transfer program where we have transit centers around the metro that connect to many bus routes on routes that customers are using for Metro Mobility. We're going to incentivize them to transfer, if they can, to a fixed route at those centers. We'll give them a free fare or a reduced fare to do that. That shortens the Metro Mobility trip, increases the service to the customer, because now they get on a light rail or a express bus and they don't have multiple stops. It reduces their travel time. And so by incentivizing that, we think that we'll shift some of the demand over to fixed route for those that can ride on fixed route, if we can get them to fixed route service. So that begins this spring, and we're going to roll that out as a pilot also. We've picked some strategic locations that have transit centers that have good accessibility, weather protected, and so not, this is not transferring at a bus stop but at a center. And so I think this will be appealing to some of the transit riders. And then we're trying, some of these adult daycare centers have said that they would be willing to be the driver of the service for their customers if we leased them the van. Hmm. So we're piloting that this year. We think that'll work. There's a big incentive for them to, the driver can then use that to get to work. They're having a hard time getting employees at these adult daycare centers. So we're going to try that. We don't then have to pay for the driver. And we're leasing the van in a way that structure is very similar to our procurement of our, not vans, but of our small buses. And so that's another pilot that we're going to be watching. We're working through a contract right now to provide that on a very limited scale. So we're trying a whole bunch of little things that we think will roll up to really provide, that can provide better service to our customers, but also manage the costs. So the task force, all the minutes, all the materials presented, the reports have been submitted, but it's all available on this website. And that concludes the presentation.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. And Representative New, questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question, and I may have misunderstood, on slide 7, you had commented, 6 and 7, I suppose, you had commented, and maybe I misunderstood, did you say that the taxing district is now bigger than it was in 2006?
Yes.
And then as a follow-up, did you also say, but the service district is still the same size? So you've increased the taxing district but not the service?
Madam Chair, members, yes, the way the law was written in 2006, it said, this is the boundaries of the Metro Mobility Service as the taxing district stands on January 1st, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, a few cities have opted into, they've chosen to join the taxing district, Lakeville, Forest Lake, Maple Plain, and one other city have joined, but the law, the way it was written, did not allow us to expand Metro Mobility to those areas. We may have expanded fixed route transit or express service to those when they joined the taxing district, but we are not allowed to expand Metro Mobility to those. There's demand for Metro Mobility in those communities, but we can't, by the way the law is written. The option that customers have in that area is Transit Link, which is a dial-a-ride service that is fully accessible, but it is not as uh, not not as available and not as robust as a metro ability. So we're restricted from expanding to those areas.
Representative New?
Yes, thank you. So why did those communities opt in then? And are they reimbursed, like for the private taxi rides or anything, or do they literally not have any access to the metro mobility? Why would they join?
Madam Chair, members, they don't have any access from their city, they joined. The Lakeville example. Lakeville joined, and they large park and ride and extensive express bus service was added as part of joining. So a lot of them join it for fixed route transit, they would like to have metro mobility service, but we just can't provide it because we're restricted by the state law for that service. Now, if they were to add all-day service transit, then the federal law would kick in and we would provide metro mobility. So it's, again, one of those complexities that we're bound by the regulations that are provided to us, even though the demand is there in those cities for our metro types of mobility service.
Representative Joaquim.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. I might have missed this in the beginning. Could you tell me what percentage of the folks that use metro mobility that qualify for it isn't it everyone that cannot use fixed ride transit, or can you explain that again?
Mr. Thompson.
Members, it's for those who are able to use fixed ride route transit but cannot because of their disability. So the best example I would have is there's people who don't have the ability to drive, but they can use fixed route just fine. There's no disability. Because they can't drive, doesn't make them eligible for metro mobility. They can use transit and they have a disability that prevents them from using the transit.
Professor Joaquim?
That's always how I've understood it too. So looking at slide 8, the program compliance, and I'm assuming that these are federal regulations and state ones that are required to get the funding for those that are using these routes?
These are, Madam Chair, members, these are requirements for how you design your service.
Okay.
And then that creates the service boundaries, and then we need the funding from the state. The federal funds are used for capital buses, but not for operations.
Got it. So, Representative O'Keefe, one more question. Just want to make. So, I was just having a hard time understanding how we could look at TNCs if they don't fit some of these requirements. So, you're saying there's some wiggle room, or because I'd hate to start us building a two-tier system where some of our folks are only able to use part of it because of their disabilities, but we're going to slide in this other system that they can't even use, and it's out of the same pool of money.
Madam Chair, members, that is one of the concerns, is that we need to design the services that can work, and so there has to be a comparable. So if we offer a TNC service, there has to be at least a comparable quality service for those who can't use the TNC. But by designing it as opt-in, it gives you more flexibility. So, there's definitely a legal risk. If we were to carve off some of the customers and provide them basically a premium service that's not available as a requirement that they use the premium service, and then not make it available for others because of their disability. And so we'll design that system. We feel the extra service models as being opt-in, and the restrictions they have in there allow us to be compliant with regulations.
Okay. So I understand you have to tread lightly. I just want to make sure that we're using our money wisely for our most vulnerable populations, that we're not taking that then and carving out. So it sounds like you already...
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, the task force was very key on that, too. They said the base service must maintain at its high quality level. These are additional services that could provide flexibility and maybe better choices for some customers, but they definitely said we're not replacing our base core services.
Yeah, especially the curb versus the walk, and I have quite a few constituents that have talked to me about that they could not function with a curb to curb.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is just clarification, and then a question as it might relate to some a meeting I had in my community. So when you say on page 24,
implemented $2 an hour minimum driver wage on October 1st, 2017. Is that a typo?
Madam Chair, it's a $2 an hour raise.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Very good.
Their minimum wage prior to October 1st was $14, and now it is $16.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. And then about when you were talking about the van leasing pilot program, I remember I visited a program at the Blaine Community Services Center on 89th Avenue. I don't know if anybody has ever been there, but they have an adult program for people to work who have disabilities. And I remember him talking to me about they were able to buy through federal funding a bus or something, but I think he told me that bus is like too big. That's really not what they need. And when you were talking about this van lease program, I thought maybe thinking that might be something that they need. But then in your words, you said something about you mentioned small bus program. So do you know what I'm talking about? And is this something that they could benefit from?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, members, if they're within the service area, not exactly sure where that location is, it's something we could talk with them about. We really have the small bus or the Chevy Equinox, which is maybe a 5-passenger. Mm-hmm. We don't have necessarily a van option, but we're not. If this leasing pilot works, we'd be open to looking at different options. There are other federal funding programs for services like that that buy vans and other things that is administered mostly by MnDOT throughout the state.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going to your comments, particularly on 22, where you're talking about the vehicles operated under the Department of Human Services. I mean, I'm just amazed at how many different names, et cetera, that I see at these clinics and the hospitals. Did you actually have a report and figures on them?
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, members, we did get a little bit into what the potential savings would be, what fare structure we could. We didn't get into the different providers. This would be the envision would be we would still be using the Metro Mobility fleet and our drivers, but we're just trying to design a program to recapture some of the cost by getting federal reimbursement. So we weren't. The task force did not explore other providers, like different types of vehicles, different companies that have their own logos. They did not get into that at all. I don't know if there's that potential or not, because the task force did not explore. They were thinking more of the model of the Metro Mobility provider and recapturing some of the costs through federal reimbursement.
Okay. And
Representative Mason?
Well, one thing, maybe for the committee, or at least for my curiosity, it really would be helpful, I think, to see, maybe have DHS give us a report on the vehicles that they're using, because my guess is that's a considerable amount of vehicles and transportation that to me seems that there's got to be a better way, that there should be a way that we could coordinate and might be helpful. The other thing is, you had mentioned about senior housing. Like, for instance, there's a facility in my district. They have their own shuttle. Problem is, about the only thing that they have that they are provided driver for is to get these people to the grocery store. And I'm wondering how many places like that, again, they have the vehicle, they just don't have a way for their tenants to be able to have at. It's not a very good use of a resource, to my
Mr.
mind.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, members, yes, we've heard many stories of that situation. A lot of those senior centers, a lot of people that live there that actually are not eligible for Metro Mobility. So that's almost a different issue altogether about they maybe have a vehicle, but they don't have a driver, they don't have other things. But it is an issue that Metro Mobility program can necessarily solve, because that group ride program that I mentioned is only for certified Metro Mobility customers. It's definitely a complicated issue.
Thank you.
So we have a couple people that would like to speak, and I'm just going to wait to take a couple more questions. But let's see if is it Mr. Waleed Sanbal, did you want to make and address the committee, sir? But yeah, we've got two or three more questions too, so. Welcome, sir. Please give us your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Sure thing. Chairman, Chair Ladies, and representatives and staff, thank you for having me. My name is Waleed Sambo. I am the CEO and part owner of Blue and White Taxi. I also represent our other cab company, which are Red and White, ABC, and Rainbow Taxi. I started this business in 2004. I took over the company. We had 40 cabs at that time. I went out and I borrowed $150,000 and started giving drivers interest-free loans so they can become owner-operators and own their own cabs. In 2007, I made my first acquisition, and now currently we're at 300 taxis across the metro area. We service about 335,000 NEMT rides, and we do a little over 600,000 cash rides. So we're close to a million rides per year. I consider us to be forefront runners in introducing technology in taxi. We had a system, we're the first one employed dispatch system in 1991. We changed that system to a better one in 2004. We were the first customer upgrade in 2006, and in 2015, I found about a system called iCabby out of Ireland. I got on a plane, went over there, and brought their system to the United States, and it's part of the fastest growing taxi cab dispatch system. In that system, they can you don't have to have an app. You can actually get a link on your phone so you can track your taxi. We have rating systems, so we get rates on drivers. We get feedback from drivers, from customers. We have a web booker where people can put a drop in and drop off and prepay their ride. And then we have our app, which is lower than regular taxi rates that we've just launched. In 2010, somebody from TaxiMagic came to me, introduced me to a backseat credit card device that was still not in production, and we were the first people to sign the contract and put them in our cabs all across the state. In 2015, we introduced cameras into our cars, and as of right now, we are changing out those cameras into newer cameras that are in a cloud-based system. So we get events of accidents when they happen. We get driving behavior of our drivers that we can watch on a daily basis and how they improve. We can download the clip over the air and grab it, so we have full exposure to what happens in that regard. One of the last things I want to mention in technology is we record every conversation on our system, but drivers and customers can talk to each other where no one's giving each other's numbers, and we have all those conversations. So we've invested a lot in technology for that regard.
Sir, can I just ask you, are you now then a vendor, a provider for Metro Mobility?
I am not. There was a RFP a while back, and I attended at that time. I was still building and trying to get there, and there were some requirements that would not allow us to get involved with this. We, in 2015, were able to find all the missing pieces and get us there. I haven't heard another RFP, but I believe now we can definitely do this because we have all the requirements that are there.
Okay. Very good.
I think one of our biggest strengths is that we are able to grow this business and still remain compliant with state, federal, and municipal law. We're an industry that is guarded and have laws by several different levels, and we're able to comply with all of them without breaking the law. We, in 2016, the new NEMT law was created, which requires 16 hours of STS training. Our drivers all have STS training now. We actually created a STS training center, that training program that actually tests them as they're taking this class, not just a participation one.
All right.
And we hired on a full-time trainer.
Great. I mean, this sounds fabulous, and I appreciate your testimony. I mean, it sounds like maybe we need to do a few updates to our current law in terms of making, you know, your match, you know, between Metro Mobility and your service. So do you see it any differently? What is your view on taking on some of their clients?
I'm here to thank the opportunity to be part of the task force, and we look forward to the opt-in program and what we can do. We believe we have the tools to make it successful for everybody, and the partnership, I think, will be great.
Wonderful. Okay. I think our time is up, and so I don't know if anybody had pressing questions. One more, quickie.
Oh, it's not actually a question. I thought someone was testifying today, Ken Rogers. And is he able to testify? He has, he's blind, and I'm sure it's not easy for him to get here. And so I'm just wondering if he was planning on testifying, can he testify?
I don't know. Is Mr. Rogers in the room?
Real quick.
Yeah, we could take a very quick testimony. I don't know if there was any other citizen that wished to make a very brief testimony. Maybe the page can help Mr. Rogers down. Right, and do we have, sir, did you also wish to, he's not. Okay, while we're waiting, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You might have said this, but is any of the program means tested?
Mr. Thompson?
Could you clarify what your definition
of? You know, I might have a disability and qualify under, sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I might have a disability, but I may also have the income to pay a higher rate to utilize the service, and maybe I missed that.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, members, we are not allowed to charge a differential rate based on their income, but we do know that they have more choices, too. We do. Some of the customers that are Metro Mobility are already on their own using Uber, Lyft, and others also. So.
All right. Mr. Rogers, yes, so welcome to the testimony table. Would you want to introduce yourself, please?
Thank you. My name is Ken Rogers, and I thought it really important to be here. I represent the Transportation Access Advisory Committee, and I was a task force member on this task force, and I thought it was really important for me to be here to help address some of your questions because I am a Metro Mobility user, and I'm the only Metro Mobility user that was a member of the task force.
Great.
So,
do you want to make a few comments then about what you've heard?
Sure. You know, our charge was big. We had a very big charge and a little amount of time to create our report. If it weren't for the Metro Mobility staff that supported the work that we did, and we created a lot of work for them, we wouldn't be able to produce this report for you all. So first I want to thank the staff that supported the task force. It was essential for us to be able to be successful. The second thing is one of the large surprises for me as a Metro Mobility user. I have not always been a big fan of Metro Mobility because of some of the limitations that exist within the program. But one of the big takeaways for me was in discovering that among our peers, we are one of the most fiscally sound and efficiently run programs of its like with our peers. So that was a huge surprise to me, and I appreciate that. It's very easy for people to think that it's just being run inefficiently. It's just a cash cow, and it's just costing the state too much money. It's very easy to go to that kind of frame of thinking. But digging down deeply, we discovered that's not the case, and that was really a very pleasant discovery for me especially.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I want you to understand that all of the options that the task force developed and talked about come with risks. They all come with pretty significant risks. So we need to look at those from a rider's perspective in determining, does it make sense to implement this type of an addition? That's one of the reasons why we suggested that we do pilot projects first to test out some of these developments that we tried to put in place.
Well, Mr. Sambo, I really appreciate you being here. We have access to you. We probably have your phone number and any of the members who wanted to follow up to kind of test your thoughts on some of this. I think we can provide that to them if you're okay with that. So I do appreciate you being here. Appreciate your participation as well. And so thank you so much. We have concluded our testimony, and unfortunately we may not have answered everybody's questions. I don't know if there was a few more citizens who wish to testify, but I'm certain we're going to take this subject up again before the session is over. Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Oh, and we are adjourned.